Hello, and welcome to the new season of the Match Volume podcast. I'm your host, Emily Rose Raboy. I'm a theater major and a screenwriting minor, and I'm happy to finally put my tuition dollars on those weird voice classes to good use. I think everyone has someone they've always been dying to talk to. For me, I've always wanted to sit down with Quentin Tarantino. If you're listening, Quentin, I always wanted to work with you. But why are your films so strange? The great thing about this show is we'll get to ask some of those burning and random questions. Maybe not to Quentin Tarantino, but you never know. We'll interview some people you've never heard of, and hopefully some people you have heard of. So turn up that volume and let's start the show. ARN host Carla Javier spoke with filmmaker Chuck Braverman about his new film, Secret Tapes of the OJ Case, The Untold Story. The film provides new insight into the OJ Simpson murder trial. Braverman has experience directing films and documentaries. His directing credits include episodes of Melrose Place and Beverly Hills 90210. His new OJ Simpson film premiered September 30th. Braverman says the project began with a conversation with his fellow filmmaker, Stephen Auerbach.
And we were just talking about projects we could do and kind of interesting stories. And we said, Stephen actually suggested that we get in touch with his friend Lawrence Schiller, who's an award-winning filmmaker, photojournalist, who lives in New York and comes out here occasionally. And I said, gee, I know Larry because I used to have an office in the same building of his years and years ago. And I said, sure, let's do a show about Larry Schiller. And we had a meeting with Larry, and Larry basically said, gee, I don't want to do a show about me. Why don't we do a show about the OJ case? Because I, Larry Schiller, was embedded in the OJ situation from day one. I knew OJ before the murders, and I wrote the best-selling book, American Tragedy, based on the defense, and so on and so forth. And I have all these recordings that no one's ever heard before. And as soon as I heard that, I knew we had a show, and I went out and sold it, and the three of us got together as executive producers, and I'm directing that episode, that show.
And I guess a question that I have is, the OJ case happened, you know, 20 years ago. There's been a lot written about it. There have been different projects kind of looking into it. What's different about this particular film?
Well, that's a really good question. And yeah, it's been 20 years. And last year, there were literally a half a dozen specials on a half a dozen different networks. And the reason is that he's the most famous American ever accused of murder. And he was a, you know, very well-loved hero. He was a football player from this university, which I also attended. And at the same time that OJ was here, he was the Heisman Trophy winner. He was the best college football player in the country when he left. He went on to play for the Buffalo Bills, where he was a huge superstar. And then he was in a lot of movies and television commercials, and everybody knew who he was, and everybody liked him. And so this event is one of those events that you just don't forget, and people remember where they were in the day of the Bronco chase. They remember where they were generally when the decision came down on the criminal case. And it started, many people say it was sort of the start of reality television. And if you think about it, you know, there would never have been a Kardashian show if it wasn't for the OJ case, because and Robert Kardashian, who was OJ's best friend, plays a very significant role in our television special.
And in the process of making this television special, did you discover something about this case that you just didn't know over all these different people who have covered it?
Well, I've worked on it now for almost 2 years. And when we started, we said, we're not going to try and decide, we're not going to try and prove that OJ is guilty or innocent. We're going to be objective as we possibly can and let other people tell the story. And that's what we did. But I must say, it became, the more we talked to more people who knew OJ really well and who knew the case and who were involved from the inside, from the outside, upside, downside, it became more and more difficult to try and be objective and say what did or did not happen, because it became, to me, it became pretty obvious what happened.
And what was obvious?
Well, I think you should watch the show and then make up your own decision. But, you know, I mean, I believe a lot less in the three or four or three or four dozen conspiracy theories, you know, that people have come up with about other people that were involved and the drug lords and the X this and that. I hate to say this, because here I am sitting on the campus of USC, which I love, and where OJ was a hero to me and to millions and millions of other people. But watch the show again, and then you tell me how you feel about it.
Chuck Braverman is a director of the new film, The Secret Tapes of the OJ Case, The Untold Story. It premieres on September 30th. Chuck, thank you so much.
Thank you.
After the infamous murder trial on the silver screen, we're going to go to the smaller screen and visit that all-too-familiar site, YouTube. ARN host Natalie Zhang sat down with YouTube personality Keenan Mossman, who you gamers probably know as Cricken. For those of you who don't procrastinate on YouTube, Mossman posts videos of himself playing videos with funny commentary. His videos have millions of views, and his channel has 500,000 subscribers. But he's not your average gamer.
Okay, my name is Keenan. I have been making YouTube videos online for about 8 years now, under the alias Kraken. They are gaming videos on YouTube where I'll play a game and kind of approach it from a creative angle and kind of try to get interesting, original content out of a game that doesn't expect me to play it that way, if that makes sense. I try to approach a game from an original perspective and kind of bend it to my will so I can make a unique video out of it.
Interesting. So you try to push the boundaries with the game?
Exactly, yeah. I look at the game and I see what affordances it allows, and then I go in and I try and push those boundaries to a place that it does something it's not supposed to, or it'll get, you know, a humorous kind of result.
What made you decide to start doing this?
Yeah, it sounds pretty crazy, but back when I was like in kindergarten, so I guess I was only like 6 years old, I would play on the playground with my friends, and the way that I like to play, and I thought I was the first one to create this, was I would actually run around the playground and I would narrate a story to my friends in which they were all the protagonists and I was the antagonist. So I would come up with situations where they were in, like, you know, a haunted mansion, and it's like they had to decide between fighting a zombie or like running out the other door. And then based on their decision, I would kind of imagine and create a story for them that I would all narrate to them. So I took that same love for storytelling and for creating my own adventures. And when I, you know, discovered video games, then I took it there and I started taking a video game and making my own stories out of those. And now I'm at USC studying game development. So I've taken my desire for storytelling from, you know, the purely narrative one to now I'm building my own game mediums for what other people can make stories out of.
Oh my goodness. And so you started commenting on these games, I guess, like around 2007, and no one else was doing it. So then from there, did you just take off on YouTube?
Yeah, well, I was still in high school. I was in middle school and then high school, so I wasn't able to do this full time. But I've never really seen this as a full time job. I've always kind of seen it as a part time job slash a hobby that I like, that I think is like a big part of me. But I ultimately want to get into game development, so I always thought, you know, I got to do well in my school enough that I can get, you know, into college and start learning game development. And the whole while, YouTube is allowing me to keep, you know, this dream alive, sort of thing. So. I definitely didn't put in the same amount of time that you'll find a lot of other YouTubers online, but I definitely put a lot of care into all my videos, and so I think the quality showed. It was more quality rather than quantity. I'd make, you know, maybe one video a month, but each of those videos would get like 500,000 views. So people liked what I created and kept coming back for more. I definitely feel like I have a community online that I can always go to for, you know, support, or if I have feedback on something, and, you know, it's nice to having people that got your back.
And because that's a large number of people who watch you. So then I'm guessing you get like fan mail.
Yeah.
Occasional fan mail.
Yeah, I get fan mail and I get recognized in person sometimes. And even at SC a couple times, I've like been, one time I was like on my way to like, you know, play squash with my roommate. And it was like the middle of the night and like some guy riding a bike stopped me and he's like, "Hey, you're Kraken." I was like, "Yeah." And he's like, "Oh, that's great." And he just rode right off.
In the dark?
Yeah, in the middle of the dark. I don't know how he saw me. It was really a little unnerving, but it's always flattering when people say hi.
What's it like though to live a double life? Is it a double life? I mean,
yeah, it definitely was, I think, more in high school. In high school, it's very much double life because by day, I was just kind of like this quiet kid keeping my head down, getting through like chemistry and math and, you know, just hated high school in general. It was not really for me. It was just very traditional. And my mind was always like looking for the next big thing, like the future, like what can I do to prepare myself like professionally and like entertainment wise, because I knew I was going to get to the entertainment industry eventually. I just wanted to do it sooner. And so then by night, I would just go home and record games and edit and live stream to thousands of people. And like, I was a celebrity when I was online, and then I'd go back to school and like, I was just quiet. So it's a very odd sort of fracturing of your personality. I still feel it in some sense that I'm kind of two different personalities.
What's your online personality like?
I wouldn't really say it's a little bit different from me. Like, so Keenan is like me personally, locally, you know, in person. But Kraken is a bit more aggressive, definitely. A bit more open-ended, a bit more outgoing. Your online personality is kind of a representation of what you do in games. So with all the eclectic games that I've played, I've kind of taken on this multi-faced sort of playful, kind of manipulative almost sort of character that when he goes to approach something, he tries to pull at the seams and break it. Versus me personally, I'm much more kind of easygoing and sure there's this side of me, but I don't really reflect it in person as I would online, if that makes sense.
Okay. Because especially like, I guess online Keenan or Kraken plays like horror games and zombie games.
a bunch of darker stuff. Not that dark, thought provoking than anything else.
So what would you define as a good game?
Well, that's tough. I define a good game as something that makes the player feel something either that they weren't expecting or that they, you know, will remember for a while.
A while as in, like, the next time they play a game or, like...
Just something that sticks with them. Doesn't matter if it's, you know, for a day, for a week, for 10 years. Like, something that they will think back on and think, like, I'm glad I did that. There.
So we can find Keenan at...
YouTube.com/Kraken2 is my channel, and my Twitter is at Crickmaster, CRIKMASTER.
All right, great. Keenan, thank you for coming on and joining us today.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Now that you know those gamer moves, it's time to take a swing on the dance floor. Our lovely Match Volume producer, Megan Coyle, took a ride on a time-traveling elevator. It was making scary noises as if it was actually from the 1940s. She arrived at the Lindy Loft, a space that serves as the dance studio and home of two internationally renowned swing dancers.
All right, can you go ahead and say your name for me?
Yeah, Sarah Breck.
And your name?
Dax Hawk.
How did you get into swing dancing?
I was 12 years old, or maybe younger than that, 10 years old, and I had been doing a little bit of cotillion and ballet as a kid, but I was watching a documentary on television of a man, Frankie Manning, and he was teaching this dance called the Shim Sham. It's kind of a staple line dance for swing dancing, and I just remember jumping on the couch and dancing with him to the TV and screaming and yelling, and my mom, as amazing as she is, she found a kids program that summer to enroll in.
Cool. What about you?
I was in high school, and swing was becoming very popular in Los Angeles, trickling down to Orange County, and I was fortunate enough to be at one of those high schools that had an after-school program for Lindy Hop. However, I was invited to that by some friends, and I didn't really give it much thought, so I didn't end up going. What ended up happening was swing blew up at my high school, and then once it got really big, it was kind of hard to ignore, and then I ended up trying it out, and I was scared of dancing for my life. I probably would run the other way when my girlfriend and her friends would start dancing. But then when I tried it, it was so much fun and it was really simple and the movement was just kind of, I don't know, goofy and easy for me to mess around with, and then I got into it from there.
And how did you guys get the opportunity to go to Istanbul to teach swim dancing?
This is our third year going, and this guy Hakan is a longtime student of Dax's. And Dax has a lot more experience with this because he's been teaching internationally since he was 16 or 17.
And what was it like teaching there this year?
You know, we were really concerned about the refugee situation, and there's been a lot of press about that. And because you were thinking of the refugees, you did tend to pay attention a little bit more to just like regular homeless gypsy families and stuff like that. So
it was almost calmer than last year in the sense of, I remember last year, or not 2 years ago, there was a lot of riot police protests going on. There wasn't this year.
That was really interesting, actually, the year before, because they were doing a lot of there was a lot of rioting going on at Taksim Square, and we were literally, we'd finish teaching a dance class, we'd go downstairs in the street, there'd be police and barricades and stuff and people rioting, and it was safe, but not safe. I mean, of course, a situation like that is always questionable, but it was pretty intense. But at the same time, what's really interesting is you have this community of swing dancers, and they love dancing so much, and they're not really afraid to be adventurous and go to cities with, things like that going on, and they're over there dancing, and other people are over there rioting, and it's kind of a big happy mix.
What are, the challenges of teaching, people, maybe who aren't American? Is there any, moves or any, concepts that they, have a hard time grasping in swing dance?
I would say the hardest challenge is just learning how to communicate what you want to do when you don't speak their language. Sometimes that can get frustrating. We'll teach a whole class without speaking, and a lot of students are used to, even English speakers, they're used to being told what to do all the time, and it can get really frustrating, but it's also a really powerful learning tool.
What can you do if you don't speak English and they're not getting it just by watching you? What do you do?
So we use a lot of visual explanation. So we'll say a word like jump while we jump instead of just saying the word jump or just jump. We also use certain things to explain concepts. So if we're trying to talk about stretch, which is a really abstract feeling in the dance, we would get a rubber band and we would one of those fitness rubber bands, and we'd wrap it around our bodies and move away from each other and let people watch that and try to, so they can see the feeling that we're trying to go for.
Can you guys describe your favorite swing dancing move?
I think almost everyone's favorite move is the swing out.
Yeah.
But it's almost this kind of slingshot feeling, and you really work off each other, and it can feel as light as a feather or as tough as you want it to feel.
She was saying it has just a very elastic type of feel, and it whips around really powerfully, which allows us to dance to really fast music, and you'll get a song which will be going we're doing tack-a-doo, 6, 7, and you do the stretch away, then you whip in on counts 3 and 4, and then you shoot her back out on 5, 6, and then kind of hang out on 7, 8, 1, 2, which creates a really cool feel. So if you kind of could imagine two people playing tug of war, it'd be tug of war, whip around, smoothly go into tug of war again and hang there for a little while, and it just keeps repeating itself. It's really a unique variation. You won't find anything like that in another dance.
What was your favorite country to teach in?
I have a love-hate relationship with teaching in Seoul, Korea.
Yeah.
Because the scene there is huge. There's actually 10,000 dancers and maybe 5 or 6 clubs running dance nights every night of the week. And it's kind of a rare phenomenon there, but it's really intense. You know, you will have a queue of people lining up to dance with you like you're an amusement park ride.
Why is it so popular? Why does it have
awesome.
Because
it's fun!
What I think is cool about the dance is you can be yourself in it. You can be sexy, you can be awkward, you can be fun. You can be aggressive, you can be passive, it really fits a lot of different people's personalities, and I think it's usually a very socially accepting environment and atmosphere,
yeah.
So a lot of people that would, even me, I would get totally intimidated trying to go to a salsa club, but for Lindy Hop, it's just different, it's more welcoming, and just the natural nature, I'm not saying the people, just the natural nature of the dance.
Okay, cool. Do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I would say, but beyond what Sarah said, if you just look at the activity itself, it's kind of one of those activities that's pretty easy to just do in a simple way, but if you really get into it, it's a lifelong process, and you never, it never has like a tangible end. It's always, there's always steps, more steps you're learning, more songs you're discovering, and there's so many facets to it. You have history, you have like the physical exercise, creativity, challenge yourself, learning things, like learning new things, and also the fact that it's a partner dance makes it a social dance. And because it's a social dance, like that's what people are striving for, is like get out, exercise a little bit, meet some people, socialize, listen to music. All that stuff is just happening every day in swing dances.
Maybe Megan and I can get Dax and Sarah to teach us how to swing. I already have the perfect dress. Well, that's it for this edition of Match Volume. The producer is Megan Coyle, and we had help from Martha Daniel. Match Volume is a podcast of Annenberg Radio News and the Media Center at USC's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. I'm Emily Rose Raboy. Thanks for listening.